Blog Talk Radio.
Brethren and sisters, be seated. Gather round me, everybody. Gather round me while I preach some. Feel a sermon coming on me. The topic will be sin, and that's what I'm against. If you wanna hear my story, then saddle back and just sit tight while I start reviewing the attitude of doing right. To accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum. Have faith or pandemonium liable to walk upon the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said we better accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said we better accept. You ain't the positive, eliminate. Mine ain't the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got that.
CBS World News, Bob Trout speaking. And again, we bring you the available reports, all of them from German sources, on what the Berlin radio calls the invasion. There is still no Allied confirmation from any source. Correspondents who rushed to the War Department in Washington soon after the first German broadcast was heard were told that our War Department had no information on the German reports. There's been no announcement of any sort from Allied headquarters in London. The first news of the German announcement reached this country at 12:37 a.m. Eastern Wartime. The Associated Press recorded this broadcast and immediately pointed out that it could be one which Allied leaders have warned us to expect from the Germans. Shortly after 1 a.m. Eastern Wartime, the Berlin radio opened its news program with a so-called invasion announcement. Columbia's shortwave listening station here in New York heard the Berlin radio say, and I quote, "Here is a special bulletin. Early this morning, the long-awaited British and American invasion began when paratroops landed in the area of the Somme estuary. The harbor of Le Havre is being fiercely bombarded at the present moment. Naval forces of the German Navy are off the coast fighting with enemy landing vessels. We've just brought you a special bulletin." End of the quotation. That is the invasion announcement as heard from the Berlin radio by Columbia's shortwave listening station. Now, here's what Transocean, one of the German news agencies, says, and I quote, "Early Tuesday morning, landing craft and light warships were observed in the area between the mouth of the Somme and the eastern coast of Normandy. At the same time, paratroops were dropped from numerous aircraft on the northern tip of the Normandy Peninsula. It is believed that these paratroops have been given the task of capturing airfields in order to facilitate the landing of further troops. The harbor of Le Havre is at the moment being bombarded." And, continues the broadcast, "German naval forces have engaged enemy landing craft off the coast." The Transocean broadcast, still unconfirmed, concludes this way: "The long-expected Anglo-American invasion appears to have begun." This is the full text of the German Transocean broadcast as recorded by the Associated Press. The German broadcasts on the long-expected invasion by the Allies were relayed both to North America and to Germans in the homeland. Germans at home were told by DNB's domestic broadcast at dawn in Europe. At 1:30 in the morning, Eastern wartime, the DNB agency repeated the items describing what it called the invasion operations. This was a departure from the usual DNB practice of giving fresh information at that time. The German-controlled Calais radio came on the air today with this announcement in the English language, quote, "This is D-Day. We shall now bring music for the Allied invasion forces." So said the German-controlled Calais radio across the channel from England.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for a special announcement from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces from London, from Colonel R. Ernest Dupuis. Go ahead, London.
This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number one will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat, 10 seconds from now. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
This means invasion. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back at Columbia's news headquarters, the newsroom in New York. I've just taken the microphone out of the studio again and back into our news headquarters. You have just heard from London Colonel R. Ernest Dupuis of the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces reading communique number one. Everything to this point has been German reports, and communique number one now says, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. It is now official. The landings have begun, and at this moment, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
As you just heard from Mr. Trout, the period of doubt is at an end, and we have official announcement of the landing of Allied armies on the northern coast of France. As there is nothing to add to the very bare words of the official communique, it was to be expected that the Allied naval forces would cover the landing and would be engaged in conveying our troops to the coast of France, and that there would be strong air support. When there is any further details to give you, we will bring them to you promptly, and we'll try to analyze them for you as well as we can within the limits of the information that we get from time to time. Now, here again is Mr. Trout.
Major George Fielding Elliott has been speaking to you, talking about the invasion. I think we can now call it that, following the reading of the first communique number one from SHAFE. That's what we call Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Forces, somewhere in Great Britain. Rather strangely, you know, just before we switched to London to hear the first communique, we were making this informal tour of the Columbia newsroom, which began at 3 o'clock in the morning, 35 minutes ago. I was standing here in front of the OWI machine and telling you that while all the other news services, the UP, AP, INS, Reuters, all the rest, were sending out all these reports and from Europe, you know, about the German reports, the OWI, which confines itself to official news, sends us the text of the communiques and all that sort of thing. The OWI was printing almost nothing, and since the beginning of the day, since midnight, the OWI had put on only one bulletin, or rather one dispatch of any kind, saying that the Romanian radio reported enemy planes over Belgrade. And, of course, a few moments after I said that, we switched you to London so that you could hear Colonel Dupuy reading the communique, and, of course, at that moment, after I came out of the studio on the OWI machine, here is what is now printed. OWI-2, meaning the second bulletin since midnight. OWI-2, flash. Supreme Headquarters announces Allies begin operations on northern coast of France. Bulletin. Communique said, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. 3:34 p.m., Eastern wartime from Washington. That's what the Office of War Information wire says. Looking over the machines now in a way is rather speculative. The whole character of this broadcast has changed, and it did change rather abruptly. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, if you have been staying with us, you know we started, sometime after midnight. I guess it was about 20 minutes to 1 in the morning, Eastern wartime, when the Germans began putting these reports out. We've been bringing you frequent reports. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, a little more than 35 minutes ago, we took this microphone here in our studio, which adjoins the Columbia newsroom in New York, and brought it out here to the news machines and began taking you on an informal tour to show you what a newsroom is like at this hour. And now I hear that we must go to London in a few moments. Ladies and gentlemen, for a broadcast from Columbia's correspondent Edward R. Murrow, we take you now to London.
March with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeat in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. This order was distributed to assault elements after their embarkation. It was read by appropriate commanders to all other troops in the Allied Expeditionary Force. I return you now to the United States.
Now we're back at headquarters again in New York. At this moment, we're in the studio. As a matter of fact, we have to come into the studio now with this unusual arrangement so that we can hear the speaker and hear what Mr. Murrow was saying. That was Edward R. Murrow, Columbia's correspondent in London. Now we're back out in the newsroom with our long cable, and once again, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The Allied invasion of Western Europe, as you know, has begun. Such an operation, carrying thousands and hundreds of thousands of troops across water to land them on a hostile shore, is one of the most dangerous of all military operations. There have been few such vast military amphibious operations in all history. Some have failed, but some have succeeded. And no such operation has ever been prepared with the thoroughness of this Allied landing on the European continent. The Allies have been getting ready for it for years. The British have been looking forward to this day ever since Dunkirk. And the moment the United States got into the war, our military leaders realized that the main road to the defeat of Germany lay through the occupied lands of Western Europe, and they began to plan accordingly. Our leaders have also realized that they must strike with overwhelming force. In some military operations, an initial repulse might have little effect, but in this European invasion, it might be fatal, for it would be a disastrous blow to the morale of the people of the conquered nations. So, the plans for the invasion were more complex and more complete than any that military strategists have ever had to work out before. Germany's dash across the Low Countries and France was simple in comparison. So was the German attack on Russia, vast as that operation was. The Allied landings in North Africa and in Sicily involved similar problems to this one, but they were on a far smaller scale. The opposition was much lighter. Nevertheless, the experience gained in these operations has been invaluable in planning for this one. We don't know as yet the details of the first landing operations, but usually an invasion force strikes in three waves. First comes the assault force, which is composed mainly of infantry, supported sometimes by light tanks, and usually also including assault engineers. Its job is to strike quickly, to break up initial enemy resistance, and to secure a foothold on the shore. Before it can land, of course, it must have the support of bombing and fighting planes and of naval artillery. And you will remember that General Eisenhower's first communique emphasized the strong naval and air support which our landing was receiving. How quickly these first waves can get ashore depends on the strength of the enemy's defenses and on the effectiveness with which those defenses are reduced by bombardment.
We take you now in a few moments for another broadcast to the British Isles. In a moment or two, our signal will be ready. We take you now to London.
Here is the text of a report sent to London by Herbert M. Clarke for the networks of the United States. This is Herbert M. Clarke in a takeoff report from an Allied expeditionary base. I don't have to explain what the takeoff is. When you hear this, you'll know that Allied forces have leaped the gap between the bases in the United Kingdom and the coast of France. We'll be there, and we'll be there to stay as you listen. As I write this, we're in an unnamed port on an unnamed coast, one of the quirks of military security. But it's a funny thing about security. A week ago in London, I was in a state of constant irritation with security censorship. It was obvious from German radio reports that the Nazis knew things we knew but couldn't say. Since then, I've been living and eating and sleeping aboard the flagship of an Allied assault force, one of the several which are going to hit the Hun where he hurts most. And I find that Jerry knows less than he said he did. Since I've been here, we've had exactly one air alarm, and that not a raid or even a determined reconnaissance. And I also find that I don't object so much to security. My loyalty and responsibility to you back home is overridden by loyalty and responsibility to the soldiers on this boat and the sailors who are carrying them to the beachhead. That objective is also, for the moment, unidentifiable, because the place we've picked for our main landing is one Jerry hadn't figured on. And I don't want to be the one to tell him that our sector is the one where his counterattack should go. The Nazis have been badly outguessed on this whole show. He's going to be surprised by the direction of the attack, and he's going to get a shock by the timing. The master race has fallen down again. I'm treating all this in the past tense as though it had already happened. Maybe that's a mistake, but it's a reflection of the overwhelming confidence of the troops involved and the confidence I've drawn from the tremendous scale of the preparations. We haven't yet moved from our anchorage, but all morning, this coastal strip has been full of movement. Ladies and gentlemen, I will digress to say that the next few sentences will be semi-numerous here that the script has been censored. There are ships in the task forces which are striking, British, Canadian, and American. They range from big troop carriers and supply ships down to landing craft. Other vessels, landing craft, which make most of the journey, piggyback on bigger ships, are in the fleet. Now I admit that I can't conceive of a fleet of ships myself, but I do know that's as far as I can see from the bridge of this ship. Others are dotting the water thickly, and I can see about 30 square miles of water. Well, ships, I'm told, half the force. Double it, and you'll have the hull. And they're all loaded with fighting men and fighting weapons, some of them still secret. For some hours, the vanguard of our force, assigned to deal with specific coastal objectives in our sector of Nazi Europe, and landing craft, lumbering through a choppy sea so slowly that they must start well ahead of time to get to their assigned places at their appointed times. These ships have been moving out. I'm speaking to shore by the last available channel of communication. We'll be following those ships soon, and I hope to be back with you before long with some harder facts. This is Herbert Clarke reporting from the flagship of an Allied assault invasion force for the networks of the United States. I return you now to the United States.
tried to help anybody, don't bring nobody back to the ship. Get back here as fast as you can to get another load. We got to get manpower on the beach. The first wave I was on, and not a man survived out of that.
As the United States was recovering from the Great Depression, President Franklin D. Roosevelt initiated a work relief program known as the Civilian Conservation Corps. Many young men, like Sherwin Callender of Oakland, California, were quick to volunteer.
And they give us Army uniforms and barracks to sleep in, and we made campgrounds and fire trails and things like that. And all the different branches, recruiting officers had come to these camps and tried to recruit us into their branch of the service. A Navy man came, he said, you'll have a girl in every port. I said, sign me up. I was the first one. That's how I got in the Navy. I went through basic training in San Diego, California, and took what they called a Four Piper destroyer to Vallejo, California, and took that down through the canal and up the eastern coast to Belfast, Maine. Then I had to ride the train down to New York City to go aboard the USS Wright. Well, I took that down through the canal again and out to Pearl Harbor. We'd go to Midway and Wake Island. We'd carry men and material out to them both. And the last time on our way back from Wake Island, a carrier passed us. We're going the same direction. We were heading back to Pearl, and they were heading towards Pearl too. And we knew it was a carrier. It was at night, but we didn't know what nationality it was. Then the next morning, we heard over the news broadcast they attacked Pearl Harbor. When we pulled into Pearl Harbor, I'd never seen such a mess in my life, and I've even had to pull bodies out of the water. One that gets me so bad that I'll never forget, I reached out and grabbed him by the hair, started to lift his body out. He was slipping. I reached over and grabbed his arm, and the meat just come right off the bone. I never forget that.
The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor inflicted more than 2,000 American casualties, and the U.S. went to war. Having experienced far more than he had anticipated, Sherwin requested a change of scenery.
I didn't want to mess with them Japs anymore, so I volunteered for amphibious training. They sent me all the way to Little Creek, Virginia, and that was the most vigorous training I ever went through.
His training complete, Sherwin was deployed across the Atlantic to take part in some of the first American campaigns in the war against Germany. Transporting units of the 1st Infantry Division, Sherwin would begin his combat experience in the invasions of North Africa and southern Italy. But the next operation would be the largest and most decisive yet, a chance to throw the gates of German-occupied Europe wide open.
Higgins boat a couple of times in. We were told, don't try to help anybody. Don't bring nobody back to the ship. Get back here as fast as you can to get another load. We got to get manpower on the beach. first wave I was on, and not a man survived out of that. We had over 100 feet of clear beach, maybe close to 200, before you could get any shelter. And the Germans was up on the hills bombarding us for at least 10 feet. The water was just blood red. Bodies all over, even dropped a gate down on top of bodies. Couldn't help it. And there was quite a few injured that we still couldn't bring them back because we had to get manpower on the beach. There was one young boy, he couldn't have been over 17. When we dropped off the load, he said, "I want my mama." We couldn't stop to help him and bring him back or nothing. It was mean. That was the worst battle I believe I was in.
The invasion of Normandy was a success, and the Allies were finally on the offensive in Western Europe. But the war was not over for Sherwin. In August of 1944, news reached Sherwin concerning his brother, Richard, a fighter pilot stationed in another part of the world.
My brother was flying P-38 over China, and his plane went down, and they never did locate it. They do have a memorial set in the ground there for him.
Despite the loss of his brother, Sherwin continued his service until the war's end. In the years since the Second World War, Sherwin has frequented schools and veteran events, sharing his story as a reminder of the cost of freedom. At the time of our interview, he was eagerly awaiting a trip back to Normandy for the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
I'm going back in June over there. That's going to be a wonderful trip.
D-Day, usually if you were there, you only have to say one word. And in your case, it was Utah. Tell me about it.
There were only 11 of us. They were all demolition men. We were supposed to take out 4 heavy weapons in Normandy, overlooking Utah Beach.
So were you a parachuter?
Yeah.
Were you supposed to parachute?
Yeah.
And you did. You jumped out of the plane.
Yeah.
How far inland were you when you jumped out?
5 to 8.
So you landed in the hours before D-Day.
Yeah, 1 o'clock in the morning.
And so when you got there, you were already behind the heavy weapons, so you couldn't take them out. You were too far away. What did you do?
I landed in the top of a tree. I grabbed the tree. It's about a 50-foot tree. Slid right there. It was wet. And I slid right down, fortunately. And when I got to the bottom, this crowd had held fire with a burp gun. That's one of those 1,400 rounds a minute. He guessed where I was, and his guess was 2 feet over my head.
Could you hear the bullets?
Hear them. He was cutting the damn grass around my head. The trees, you know. A lot of shrubs and all.
What'd you do?
I was too scared to pee in my pants, so I didn't pee in my pants.
You had your encounter with someone trying to kill you the minute you landed. There was no delay. The second
before,
you landed...
Before, I didn't have my weapon out.
Had you ever been in battle before?
Nope.
And how old were you?
22.
So...
But I was an elderly 22. I got my rifle, put it together. I'm standing there on a road 20 feet wide, dirt, and nobody's around me. I'm alone on D-Day. Can you imagine? How the hell can you imagine that even? And I'm standing there, and I'm scared shit. I mean, I am scared.
Okay, so you're behind the lines of Utah, and about 3-4 hours later is when the invasion begins. Were you close enough to the beach to see it?
When I started, there were already people on the beach.
Could you see the ships on the horizon? Could you see them coming ashore?
Oh, you could see them coming in, yeah.
What was that like?
It's not something you can explain. You have to be there and see it, or it's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable.
I've heard people say, both on the American side and on the German side, that when you saw the number of ships approaching the beach, everyone knew this was going to be the end of the war.
It's so big. It's bigger than you are. You can't even imagine. You start seeing stuff, but you see individual situations, explosions and stuff.
You were able to see what was going on the beach. Did you see people getting killed and the running and all that?
Well, you saw the aftermath of when they got hit.
So right away, you were engaged in, you killed people.
Personally,
you,
yes.
You shot people.
Yeah, the one guy.
The first time you shot, when you shot that man, what'd
you... You don't even think about it.
Not in combat.
It's self-preservation.
Have you thought about it since?
A lot of times.
And what is...
It's the kind of thing that's quite personal. And I abhor violence. I was always the guy, if there was a little guy getting hurt, I was the guy that stepped in, because I was an orphan. I had more battles for other kids than I did for myself.
So I
was pretty good.
So you think about the fact that you had to kill people.
Oh, I loved combat when I was a kid. And when I got older, I abhorred it, you know.
How long did it take before you saw your first dead American?
I would have been with the Air Force guy.
And was it something that you just said?
It was up near that road, near where the trees were being grown. That's the first guy.
It was one of those things where
he wasn't one of my men.
Yeah.
I don't know where he came from.
But it was one of those things where you said, I can't think about this now. I got to keep going.
You don't have time. Everything happens so damn fast, you don't have time to think. That could cost you your life.
Did you understand what an event this was? What a momentous event this was? Did you know?
All I gave a shit was I wanted to kill Hitler.
And get home okay?
I wasn't worried about that. That'll take care of itself, yeah. They murdered our men. And if they knew that I had blood coming out, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be there.
Do you sometimes think about your buddies who died?
Too often. I was supposed to be tough, and they'd see me off in a corner, tears coming down my cheek. And I never told them what it was about.
This was in later years?
Yeah.
What do you want to say? You know, your generation isn't going to be around in 20 years.
I'm disappointed. Do you know that the young people today have not been taught the history of this country and all the crap that we went through? They haven't been taught that. They got these bunch of, what the hell do they call these guys, professors? If I ever got in a corner with them, I'd knock this. I'd start on their balls.
This is the G.I. Jive, Man Alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Jack, that's the G.I. Jive. Rootledy-toot, jump in your suit, make a salute. Voot! After you wash and dress, more or less, you go get your breakfast in a beautiful little cafe they call the Mess. Jack, when you convalesce, out of your seat, into the street, make with the feet. If you're a PVT, your duty is to salute the L-I-E-U-T. But if you brush the L-I-E-U-T, the M-P makes you K-B on the Q-T. This is the G.I. Jive, Man Alive. They give you a private tank that features a little device called Fluid Drive. Jack, after you revive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk, fall on your bunk, clunk. Private tank that features a little device called a fluid drive. Jack, if you still survive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk, fall on your bunk, clunk. Soon you're counting jeeps, but before you count to five, G.I. Jive.
And now for the last number of our engagement here, presenting Buddy Rich, Ziggy Elman, Tallulah Winters, and the girls in the Hawaiian War Chant. Take it, Buddy.
Bye. Hey, everybody. James Bostic here. A conservative's perspective. Welcome to our D-Day retrospective. Happy to be here with you. Clearly a man out of time. I have done not exactly, well, yeah, I guess it is tooting my own horn a little bit, but you know what? Dizzy Dean said, if you can do it, it's not bragging. And I have done a couple of pretty decent shows in the time I've been doing this. I've done some good work. But the two programs that I am absolutely positively the most proudest of are the D-Day retrospective and the Pearl Harbor retrospective. Those two. And I know they're not particularly news commentary kind of thing, which is allegedly my jam, but those two programs, I think, probably some of my best work, really. Good to be here with you. We are late in celebrating our D-Day, using our D-Day retrospective. But it is good to be here with you. You know, I haven't been on the air too much here lately in the last few weeks. And it's been crazy because the end of school year coming up and going. And there was just a lot of activity and a lot of events going on all at the same time. And I was having a tough time trying to figure out everything. So it was kind of like putting 5 pounds into a 3-pound bag. Something had to give. So I took a few weeks off from the show. But it is good to be back. And it is nice to ease into it with this sort of thing right here. This last Sunday, June the 6th, I was in Greenville, South Carolina, and I was part of a thing called Rock the Red, and that's a political convention that goes on down there a little late this year. Usually it's in January, and it will be in January again next year, but and I've been to this thing before. It's a terrific event, lots of top-notch speakers and activities. And it has special meaning this year because my reenactment unit, most of you know I'm a Civil War reenactor, and I have been for about 25 years. And I'm captain of a group called Bryan's Battery, and it was a West Virginia Confederate artillery unit. And its place in history is significant because there was a young man named Milton Humphreys, and 18, 19 years old, and he was mathematically inclined, and he was one of the people to give practical application to the concept of indirect fire, and that means hitting the thing that you cannot see. And, you know, that's a mainstay of military tactics for artillery to this very day. Everyone does it. But in those days, it was a novel concept. And I sent a picture of our cannon. We have a 3-inch ordnance rifle, the battery does. And I sent a picture of it to my friend Don Newen, who along with his wife Nana Fiducia have Cowboy Logic Radio and the Ops Lens with Rocky Stucci at Mojo 5-0. And I said, wouldn't this be nice if they used this as kind of like the starter's pistol to get the ball rolling at Rock the Red? And he said, yeah, that would be terrific. Let's call Presley Stutz. And within, you know, a couple of hours, I was in this conversation with the event organizer. Long story short, we came to the event and we were the starter's pistol, but we also conducted demonstrations throughout the course of the event. We had the distinct honor of serving as color guard for the morning ceremony on Saturday. And then, of course, on Friday afternoon, we did that as well. The highlight of the thing, as far as the battery was concerned, or at least for me anyway, there were a number of celebrities that were brought up and, you know, as a treat, ceremonial kind of thing, they got to pull the lanyard and fire the cannon. We would give them brief instruction on how to do that, and then they would come up. Lynn Wood, the attorney, Lynn Wood was there. He did it. Former ICE director Tom Holman also pulled the lanyard. But the celebrity... I'm still basking in the afterglow of that. Excuse me. The one that was the really big deal, the biggest deal of all, was Lieutenant General Michael Flint. And on Saturday evening before dinner, after which he was the keynote speaker. We worked with him on the gun. We showed him the number four position. He didn't have any problems with it. And we had a terrific time, and he pulled the lanyard on our gun. Very nice man, very gracious, had pictures taken with the battery, and quite an honor, really was. And it was a terrific event. Trevor Loudon was there, a guest on the program. Claire Lopez, also a guest on the program. I'm trying to think of some of the other notable speakers. K. Carl Smith, Lynn Wood, of course, General Michael T. Flynn, former Ambassador Henry Cooper was there. And it was just a great show, and we had a terrific time. The battery, all the people in the battery were there. Melissa Petrie was there. My lieutenant, Tim Walker, was there. Danny Hamilton, not with the battery, but an ex officio member of the battery now, because we pressed him into service to work on the gun, and he stepped in and took instructions, and away we went, and we had a terrific time. Rock the Red, Greenville, South Carolina. They'll be running this thing again 2021 in January. Or 2022, rather, January. And, I'm going to be there. And that's all we're going to talk to you about that. I want to get back to this thing on our D-Day retrospective. We have more of that here now. Stories of Pointe du Hoc.
We are Rangers true under red, white, and blue, and we fight for the right we adore, with our battle cry ringing through the sky, putting freedom on every shore. Well, when the Rangers come, there's no beat of a drum, but the flash of a cold steel blade. We'll fight, fight, fight for right, 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 just another famous Ranger raid. I got in the boat. When we pulled away, the water was rough and it was cold. And as we came in closer and closer to the shore, that's when we start seeing these 88s, or what the hell they were, flying over the top of us. You could see them, you know. Well, by that time, I had thrown up through my vomit bag. They gave us a bag, you know. And my job was to hook the grappling hook on the rockets to fire the rope up the cliff. When they told us to load up, you know the last thing I said to myself? I didn't say it to myself. I said it to the guy upstairs. I said, "Dear God, don't let me drown. I want to get in and do what I'm supposed to do." I'm starting to break down.
I was the last man off of my boat. Bullets were zipping by, but none hit me, thank God. I got a hold of the rope right in front of me and started up. And I got about two-thirds of the way up, and this hellacious explosion. The last thing that I saw was all of this mud, dirt, and rock coming down the cliff. And then I was knocked out. The next thing that I recall was I was buried up to about my waist. And I looked up and I could see this German up there. And looking down like that. He could have shot me right there if he wanted to, but I guess he figured I was gone, you know. So I looked around for my rifle. No, I had a Tommy gun, and it was some feet away, and I managed to squirm around and finally pull it out. And this fellow was still up there and looking around the other way, and I took a shot at him and pulled the trigger, and it snapped. My gun was clogged up with mud, and there I was. And I remember saying to myself, ain't this a hell of a note? Here I am in the damnedest war in history, and I don't have a gun.
The first thing about the beach that you notice is there are dead men all over it. And the few that are still quivering are bleeding badly. There are a whole pile, and I actually literally mean a pile, of terrified men leaning up against the seawall, one on top of another, not beside each other, but on top of one another, trying to get into the cover there. You see puffs of dust as machine gun bullets and rifle bullets are hitting in your area. You hear the smack of bullets as they hit into the breakwaters, and you can hear them go whang off and as they ricochet, but you can also hear that thump as they hit a rock and scatter fragments of rocks all over the place. You would hear the artillery exploding behind you as they hit the boats on the waterline, the shoreline. And the rifle fire and the machine gun fire was just incessant as it cracked over your heads, as it hit into the breakwaters, as it chewed up the turf, as it banged into the road next to us. And it was one horrible noise after another, with a lot of little nasty noises in between. And of course, when the artillery would hit near you, the whole ground would shake. You'd have dust and fragments and things like that come and litter around you. No, it was a scene from hell.
As our ramp went down, I'm the first one off the landing craft, and as I did, I was shot through the side, above my hip, through the muscle on the right side. Fortunately for me, my side was sore and hurt from the shot, but it didn't hit anything important. Bob, my radio man, was next to me on his rope, and we're struggling and about to make the top when Bob says to me, Len, can you help me? And I said, what's wrong? He said, I don't have an ounce of strength left. I can't make it. And it was only about a foot or two to the top of the cliff. And I said, Bob, now that you mention it, I don't think I have an ounce of strength left either to make it, but you got to hold on. I happened to see Leonard Rubin. He was a very husky fella, and I yelled to him, Rube, get over here. And I said, Bob can't make it to the top. He's out of strength. Can you help him? With that, Rube throws down his weapon, reaches over, grabs Bob, and he is so powerful, my man. He jerked Bob up over the cliff, slung him over. Bob's going through the air. In the meantime, I've gained enough strength to get up, and I'm standing up there with my submachine gun, protecting Bob and Rube. And the Germans and Rangers are being shot all around us. As we rushed them, we got to the gun positions that we were assigned, and there were no guns. What was there was these phony poles making it look from the air as if the guns were in those positions. I told my platoon sergeant, Jack Hume, you come with me. I said, you're not going to go find those guns. They got to be here. Down this one sunken road, we saw what looked to be wagon wheel tracks. We came to a hedge road. I had to look over into an apple orchard, a sunken apple orchard. And there, lo and behold, are the guns of Point de Hoc.
When you hear the cry of medic, there's no choice. You don't think about anything except you have to go. There's no choice, regardless of what's happening. You tended him and took care of him, if possible. If he was dead, you went on to the next guy. Later, it would hit. But at the time, nothing mattered except your job. But later on, every once in a while I think of Sergeant Otto in F Company, who I got along with very well and liked. He was on the top a very short time when he was hit in the belly. And the wounds, these wounds, like that, took just simply a hole in the abdomen. And nobody paid much attention to it. I mean, they didn't know any better. Didn't pay much attention to it. Just get to the medics and they'd take care of it. We had him in the aid station, what we made into an aid station. I got him and I saw what it was and insisted he lie down. Typical of a wound of that sort is that the bullet will go in and sometimes it'll go all the way through and it'll tumble and do extensive damage. The pain is enormous. We kept him under as much as we could with morphine. And eventually when we were relieved, of course, he was evacuated, but he died aboard ship. But I think of him every once in a while as I remember him because we were friends. These are men who live in your memory. But all this, the personalities become frozen. They never develop. The people never develop. They're stopped in time and place. These were living human beings. Some of them a little nutty, some of them irritating. All of them were real. And the sacrifice is of all of these characteristics, all of this personality. All of the futures gone.
Calling their mother. They would call mama. We loaded on them boats and off of them boats for a week or 10 days every day. And each time we would be loaded on, we'd think, well, this is it. And to answer your question, was when we moved out and thousands of planes, it sounded like a roar over our head, and we hadn't gone very far in that water until we could hear the artillery from the coast, French coast. Then we knew that was the day that it was going to, that was happening. There was heavy fog, and of course the sea was rough in A Company. They were the first ones to hit the Homeyard Beach, and that was the biggest percentage of them were wiped out. One of our chaplains that went in on the same boat with me, he used to say, you try to save the, I'll try to save the soldiers. You try to save their lives and I'll try to save the soldiers. But see, a chaplain was in outfit. He had to be all, whether he's Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, and all. But he went back and turned to one of the men who fell and hollered for help. And he turned to pick him up. And I don't know what hit him, but his body went and his head wasn't there. Just some things stand out in your mind that you don't try not to think about or talk about too much. I just have been so fortunate then and since, and with a good family, and thank God, try to thank God every day that, and you know, I'm one of a lot of people say, well, the Lord did this, the Lord did that. I don't think the Lord, well, take this chaplain that I'm talking about. Nobody can ever convince me, because he was the only chaplain there to console and pray with these soldiers. I can't be convinced that the Lord jerked his head off and leave him without it.
It was still dark, but then as we headed into the beach, all the ships and everything started firing, and it was one awesome sight. It was, like I said before, of over 1,000 Fourth of Julys, and it was really something to see. I mean, the whole beach lit up, the whole ocean lit up with firing from guns and everything else. And I thought nothing of it. I mean, we're heading toward the beach until all of a sudden bullets were hitting on the side of the ship and the water, and I looked into the well of the boat, and there was 35 soldiers in there, and I don't think there was an atheist in there, because every one of us was making a sign of the cross as we were going in. And I happened to look. I looked to the right, and I seen a boat get hit. And there it was, I realized what we were going into. As I hit the beach, Wally Lawton lowered the ramp, and the soldiers started pouring out. And I seen them dropping. I seen them getting shot. I seen them, their faces blown off. God, it was an awful sight. It's a sight I'll never forget. It's been in my mind since. This is the first time I ever talked about it. I hope it's my last. As they were going off, there was one soldier there that didn't want to leave. I guess he froze. He seen what happened in front of him. And we were instructed not to take anybody back unless they were wounded or dead. As I lifted up my arm, tell him to get off, I was shot over here and it came out my back. And as he went over, I don't know whether he got hit or not, I backed the boat out. And as I backed the boat out, we were passing the second waves that were coming in and the third waves that were coming in, and all of a sudden I started feeling faint, and one of my crew members took over the boat and we back to the ship. And that was D-Day for me. An awful bloody sight. I remember that day after I got wounded, and the four of us was there and we were all crying. Not over me, but what we saw. The four of us. We couldn't believe it. And Brian, he had studied to be a priest. And he was the one that prayed the most, I guess, for all of us. And I was very, very fortunate. I mean, I missed the obstacles. I landed on a beach, and I can remember the soldiers telling me, go all the way in. I don't want to get wet. I don't want to get wet, you know. They didn't get wet. They got killed.
I volunteered to go in the Navy. And then when we got to Scotland, they were looking for 100 volunteers. And I volunteered again to get into this outfit, demolition outfit. And from there, from Scotland, we went down to Devon, England. And we used to train at Land's End in England because the beach was almost similar to Omaha Beach. And we did that for I forgot how many weeks. And then we went to Plymouth, and we knew the invasion was on. They told us that the invasion was on, and we sailed from Plymouth over to Normandy. And we, our job was to blow up these obstacles. They had what they call hedgehogs, and then they had these telephone poles with a ramp, and on top of the telephone pole was a mine. That was for when our tide came in, the boats would just slide up there and the mine would explode. And our job was to blow up 50-yard gaps so the infantry could land. As we're crossing the channel, it was rough.
Just a lot of choppy seas and...
Yes.
Yeah.
I carried a rifle and a web belt with canteen and ammunition and a rifle, and I forgot how many pounds of explosives I had on my back. I believe they called it tetratol. And as I got to the ramp of the small boat that was in the land, there was just as I jumped into the water, there was this explosion. And while I was in the water, maybe a couple of seconds, someone pulled me out, and I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find any of the crew that I was attached to. The number of the small boat we were on was 13. I found out later that they were all killed. I was the only one left. I managed to crawl up the beach, and because the tide went out very far, but when it came in quite fast, and it left a very small beach. And that's when, as I was crawling in the beach, I looked back and I could see these tanks that were supposed to float. They just sank. They went right to the bottom. And I got up on the beach and one of the tanks made it, but it got stuck, and it lost its thread on all the small rocks. And as I was laying there, I couldn't find any Navy men. And you could tell the Navy men because on our helmets we had a blue stripe that went around the helmet. As I was laying there, there were no foxholes. I mean, the planes, believe me, not one bomb dropped on that beach. So everybody was laying down, and it seemed like every time a shell, you could tell when the shells were going over your head because they'd make a swishing sound. But the ones that were close, you never heard that sound. And there were some Army men about 10, 15 feet from me laying down with a medic and an 88. They called them 88s. The shells hit them, and they were gone. And there were body parts all over the place. I remember this one. He must have been an officer because he said there are two kinds of people on this beach, those that are dead and those that are going to be dead. I remember that. And we stayed there a few days, and that was about it.
I was most worried about trying to remember all the things I was supposed to do and the things I need to be concerned about. The people talk about fear, and I guess there was fear, but mostly it was concern about doing what you're supposed to be doing and doing it right and being able to protect your men and kill the Germans. I guess you have to say that. On my way over, I could see planes as far as you could see, the red lights. And when we went over, finally got over the shore, I looked down and saw the beach of France, and I thought, beautiful beach down there. And before it got very much further, maybe a minute, maybe 5 minutes, I don't know, and I started seeing flak coming up at the plane. And I had a radio man who was looking out the door with me down at seeing this stuff, and he put his arm up in front of his face like that, and I slapped his arm down and said, get your goddamn hand down. It won't stop a bullet. You'll just get blood all over your face. I tell you that because I can remember it, but also I think showed more the kind of spirit that everybody had. We had a job to do. And that is still in my memory now. It wasn't very long after that somebody said to me, Stout has been hit. And Stout had been the guy that had refused to jump once back in England, so he was told he couldn't go in, and he wanted to go very bad. I'd had to take Stout up to up by myself and tell him he had to jump without my pushing him or he couldn't go with the unit. And he went. And so when I went back, I unhooked my book, my static line, and went back. He was only four men back because I had a big sergeant behind him if he had to be pushed. And I got back there and looked at him, and he didn't look hit. And I wondered, my God, was that premonition? Did he faint? Maybe I'll just throw him out. But I made the decision, well, less time than it takes me to talk about it, and put him on the bucket seat and laid him down. And at that point, somebody yelled at me, the green light is on, Lieutenant. Now, I'd already had the boys stand up and hook up, because the red light had been on earlier. And And I, at that point, I turned. I said, hollered at the group, Geronimo, let's go. And I turned and went out. I don't remember anything until I hit the ground, and it was the softest landing I ever had. My feet just touched the ground as I went down, and I was just barely, I was hung up in a tree. And I couldn't get out of my pair. I jump up to loosen the snaps and to unsnap, and I go up in the air instead. I finally had to get my jackknife or my knife out and cut the straps to get out. And I can remember there was a house about 50 to 100 yards away, and I wondered if there were people in that house. I could hear the guns on the shore opening up with the bombardment. I could hear that all the time, every morning, noon, and night, all during that period. I could see very nearby tracers going up. I dropped it below. I know now what it was. I just talked to this fellow, and I talked to the sergeant who was captured, and it was near there. There was an Army base or an Army detachment set out in that area, and I must have gone near them. But after I got away from there looking for my men, I was all alone. The only thing I got scared of, really, right into, because I avoided roads and so forth, was cows. I was sneaking up on cows because I thought they might be some of our men. And I didn't use the clicker. I never believed in the clickers because I figured it was more harm than good. I was all alone, and we were supposed to be just follow the plane. Follow the way the plane was going. If you weren't going on the direction that we were supposed to, they gave us the direction that we were supposed to be flying on so that we could go down that way normally. And so I started off in the direction I thought the plane might have been, but I've traveled all night looking for men. And the only thing I can remember about that night was that I got close enough to a German, that I had to get down. I got down on my elbows to crawl away from where he was. And the thing that one reason I remember is because I had my binoculars out. I put them on, or put them whatever I had them. And they hung, and when I crawled on my elbows, the damn binoculars got in the way. And so for the first time, I decided when daylight came that I couldn't go any further. I'd be killed or captured or what have you. So I found a hide in a hedge. Oh, I didn't like my hide then, so I moved to another hide. And while I was at that hide, I had a good-sized tree by me, and there was shooting off about a quarter of a mile where I thought that town was, and I thought, I was looking over the, out of the hedgerow, over the hedgerow, to see what was going on there, and I couldn't see anything, but I sat down then, started to sit down, and as I sat down, a German walked right in front of me that I hadn't seen, and he hadn't seen me. Fortunately, I had my Tommy gun cocked because doing that other thing just automatically. And when he came around the tree, I'm trying to remember whether he had his gun slung over his shoulder. I think so. But I just stitched him all the way up with a machine gun. And that was the first period. That was the most difficult period I had in all my whole career because I thought he was the point of a squad, and I was sitting there expecting any minute to get shot. I was saying to myself, I wonder if I know when I die, if I'm going to get if I feel the bullets while they go at me or anything. And I was looking out over across the field. It was 200 yards to the next hedgerow, expecting I could see people, and I couldn't. Pretty soon I realized, well, I got to get the hell out of here. So I moved to another house.
Welcome back, everybody. James Bostic, A Conservative's Perspective with our D-Day, the Normandy Invasion Retrospective. It is distressing to me on a number of levels that you see less and less frequently stories like we've heard this evening or the history of this incredible event. I was born in 1962, and through the early and mid-60s, the memories of the Second World War and the men that fought it were still fundamentally green. All those young kids in their 20s, well, they were guys in their, you know, late 30s, early 40s. They were my uncles. And, excuse me, going to have to hit the mute button. Hang tight. And we're back. I hate it when I have to do that. I apologize. Where were we? Oh, these memories were still very fresh. And, you know, the men that fought that war at that time, you know, they weren't really that old. They were still fairly young fellas. But time marches on. And in doing so, it seems that it is somehow easier to let these events fade. And I just wonder if they should. With the exception of Desert Storm and the coalition forces used there and logistics and the coordination in the battle planning, the Normandy invasion was the mightiest military operation in the history of the world. It had one purpose and one purpose only, and that was the destruction and the defeat of Nazism and tyranny throughout Europe. I'm still here. I'm just thinking about all this. Without the planning, the brilliant planning, and the sacrifices, as we've heard in these veteran stories this evening, the Allies might not have ever defeated the Nazis. On June 6, 1944, more than 156,000 American, British, and Canadian troops stormed 50 miles of Normandy's fiercely defended beaches in the north of France in an operation that ultimately proved to be a critical turning point in the war. It took years of planning. They started with the earliest vestiges of Overlord in late 1942. They looked at invading France as early as 1943. But Roosevelt and Churchill had talked it over and decided that what they would do instead would be to invade North Africa first and attack Europe's soft underbelly through Italy. It was the largest amphibious operation in military history. 156,115 U.S., British, and Canadian troops, 6,939 ships and landing vessels, 2,300, almost 2,400 aircraft, and 867 gliders that delivered airborne troops. Hard work, quick thinking, people not hesitating to show initiative and sacrifice. Lots and lots of sacrifice. Take a little musical break. Going to take a little musical break right now. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Omaha. Or as they called it in those days, Bloody Omaha. That was where the highest number of casualties took place throughout the length of the invasion beaches. We will be back with the conclusion of our D-Day retrospective right after this.
Ain't got a dime to my name.
To my name.
What a terrible shame. Ho, ho, ho. Ho, ho, ho. Ho. Just found a hole in my shoe when my stocking shows through. Ho, hum. Ho, ho, hum. I know that when you're as free as a bird in a tree, life is a wonderful whim. Look at the crank with his dough in the bank. Don't you feel sorry for him? Rolling along at a loss, never gathering moss. Ho, hum, ho, 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 hum. Ho, hum, ho, ho, hum. I'm no terrific success, I often worry, I guess. Ho, 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 ho. I like a shady old tree, what's the matter with me? Ho, 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 ho. There's nothing quite as grotesque as the man at the desk. Looking outside at the sun. Shirts made of silk and a diet of milk. Maybe he thinks he has fun. I've got the vagabond itch. I guess I'll never get rich. Ho, hum. Ho, 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 ho. Ho, 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 ho.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
It was low tide, and the beach was, my God, it was more than 300 yards from the low tide up to the, so we were still 20 or 30 minutes off of being in to where we dropped the thing. Mm-hmm. And when they would come by like this and just, I think it was kind of like stay out of our territory, the machine guns kind of, and they would go across that thing up front and then hit water and stuff, and it was mostly fear they weren't going to kill us right then. But that's when I said, the guy said, how are we going to get out of this thing? I said, we're going in here, and the one that seems to be giving us the most, hitting us the most is up there. I'm going over the right side. And this is a matter of life and death. You don't need a boss to tell you this. You do whatever you think is right for you, but I'm going over the right side. Well, of course, most of my guys went over the right side. I think some of them who couldn't crawl over the thing to go over, tried to go down the ramp, and they didn't make it. And a couple of them we threw over it.
They got hit by machine gun fire as the ramp dropped, and they tried to go out the front?
As soon as the ramp dropped, they had zeroed in, and that whoever went down the ramp, some of them got hurt real bad, others got killed right there. Mm-hmm. But I'll bet you we were in 8 feet, and trying to get up with all this stuff to get a breath, you couldn't do it, so I just shed my pack and helped other guys I was trying to pull up out of there get up long enough to get a breath. And then they said, what about the pack? I said, don't worry about the pack. Of course, I didn't realize then, but there was plenty of packs to be found on the beach because guys were dropping. If they didn't drop in the water, they'd drop them up there because you had to move fast on the beach. Mm-hmm. To pick up from here to the window would be a good gain on the beach where you had to hit the dirt again because of the machine guns. So it was getting off the boat was a mess. We should have drowned, and some of the boys did, but most of them I was able to get a hold of, or they would have to push me, and we'd get up over there. And you only had to go from here to the second coffee table because the bomb crater was like this. Mm-hmm. But getting breath to get up there was a big problem with all that mm-hmm. stuff on. That's why we started dropping stuff there and, mm-hmm. and grabbing other guys and pulling them till they could get up and get a breath there. And that in itself was real scary.
Mm-hmm. Once you got on the beach, how did you get protection?
No protection when you're on the beach.
Okay, so are you seeing muzzle flashes?
Oh, yeah. Tracers. But what I was watching was there were a machine gun nest there and one here. This one seemed to have the best angle on us, and that one over there was apparently going this way and this way. So I was watching this, and when he would go by, I would make a run just because I'd drop my pack and everything else and served my guys as hard as we could go, and if we could get from here to your wife, that would be good, and then hit the beach again because you knew he was going to be coming back with it. And when you hit the beach, you'd actually hit it so low your helmet would come off and roll there, and you'd try to grab it and put it back here, so you got hit there, and there was nothing to get down into. You're just, it would be like going to the beach to go swimming or something, and just, but there was lots of pebbles and stuff on the beach too, and I saw guys get hurt bad with that. The machine gun missed them, went right by them, but in going by, it hit some of those pebbles and stuff, and just they exploded just like a grenade would explode, and the pieces of all the stuff would like this, and just cut them all up from the pebbles. They didn't get hit, but they were hurt, and some lost eye problems and things from it, and some on the side of the head, I missed that, but there was no place else to go. You had no... Then if you remember on the beach, you go up so far and then there's a rock break, like a little rock break. My goal was to get to that rock break where I could look around and see where my guys were because half my platoon was gone. We got on the boat. The boat went on the hole 24. I had 45 guys. Hmm. I don't know whether that boat was getting in. From then, I didn't know where my guys were. I only knew the ones I had, and I'm not going to tell you a number exactly because I'm not sure how many of them were already killed or badly wounded. So I'm fighting a platoon objective was maybe 15 or 20 guys at the most, then I didn't think he's, well, by the time I got up to the cliff, I know I wasn't, I didn't have that many. But we're trying to get up to that rock break. I'm trying to keep them spread out, because if they drop a piece of artillery in on us, whether it's
a mortar?
Whether it's a mortar or whether it's a shell from a 88, whatever drops on us, if we're all together, we're all going to keep spread out. And I didn't want to either. I want to be close to you, because you and me are going to make it together. But I finally convinced them to stay apart, because guys were dropping everywhere. And so some of us got up to that rock break, and then we kind of got together at the end of rock break and started deciding how we was going to get from here up to the wall, to the hill. So the reason I'm talking to you today is one of the ships from a mile at sea or more, maybe, finally got coordinates. They were afraid to fire before Cato dropped short on us. Mm-hmm. When they finally got enough coordinate information to know where they had to be, then they started firing. And then with that, with the 101st Airborne coming in from the back up there, it diverted some of the stuff away from us, and that's why any of us are alive.
Okay, Art, obviously from the time your LCI, you know, approaches the beach, they're firing on you, the shells are hitting the MCI. You've got 24 of your 45 guys in your company on your LCI. And you're seeing men be killed.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible.
Emotionally, I mean, what did that do? What are you thinking?
You almost went brain dead. Like one of the guys grabbed right beside me at the moment. Before that, he grabbed one of those posts that the Germans had out there to keep the posts. And I didn't realize it then, but there was a mine on it. The machine gun came in and didn't hit him, but hit that mine and blew. It's not nice. There was nothing left of him. He was gone.
And how close were you to that when that happened?
From here to that China closet. Mm-hmm. And then again, I was running, you know, as low as I could be, and most of it over me there, mm-hmm. left over shrapnel. Mm-hmm. And then going on the beach, I'm really close to a guy probably from here to that first thing there, and I'm saying, spread out, keep spread out. And we saw it coming there, we knew it was coming, we could hear. And we both dove, and I hit the sand here, and he hit it there. When he landed his stomach on a landmine. When you land on it with your feet, it comes up like this and cuts you in half. When you land on it with your stomach, nothing. No dog tags, no arms, no legs, no nothing left but blood. Mm-hmm. Terrible, just mm-hmm. terrible. Mm-hmm. Then you know you're at war. And now you're so scared you don't know, you keep fighting because you don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. And you know what real fear is, and you think, but I'm still alive, I can't go backwards. I mean, this all goes through your mind that fast. And if I'm going to stay alive, I can't be laying here. I got to, and between now and then, there's great officers were up there somewhere hollering, come on, get off the beach, you're going to get killed anyhow, get up here, get away from the water, get up here. And I'm thinking, these guys are right. I would make my 5 or 10 yards every chance I could, and the guys on my left or right, I say, go with me, but go off to the side, stay on the side. And some of us got up there and some of us didn't. And medics were wonderful, but no medic in the world could cover the ground that had to be covered that day. You're working on this guy here, and I say, take care of him, I'm going to go. And I make my run and look back, and there'd be one there and one there. We had at least two medics on the ship with us, and if we had 15, there wouldn't have been enough. It just can't be every place. It was in legs and arms, and mm-hmm. it's a bad thing to talk about.
Yes, I understand. To most contemporary Americans and people around the world, their impression of that is the first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
What's your impression of is it accurate?
First time I saw it, I'll tell you, it was accurate. I walked out. I couldn't. As soon as it got started like that, I walked out. I couldn't handle it. I probably waited a month, went back and sat through it, and I come out of there like this. And the first time I went back to the beach, I knew all at once I couldn't talk to the people I had taken there to show what happened, so I just acted like I lost something. I went walking down the beach, and I must have gone a couple or 3 minutes till I got a hold of myself and went back. So, and even today, when I was there last winter, it was or last fall, it wasn't. I choked, but just for a little bit. It's just.
So you think Steven Spielberg accurately portrayed what you guys faced?
So accurate.
I mean, it, as much as anything on so set up like that could.
So accurate. It was scary accurate. But looking at it from that angle, it really scares you. I don't know that I was scared, but I was so scared I didn't know I was scared. You know, I knew what we had to do, and you had to get it done, and you could stand there and get killed, or you. If you're going to get killed anyhow, you might as well do something about it. That's...
Who finally got the troops moving off of bloody Omaha? Well, if such a confused, potentially disastrous experience could be said to have been saved by the pure grit and leadership of any one man, even a few, nominations for that honor would have to start with a West Pointer, a single-star general in his 50s, who was practically elderly in comparison to the men all around him. That would be Brigadier General Norman Cota. Dutch was 51 years old. He was the assistant commander of the 29th Infantry Division, a veteran of the Allies' North African campaign, and spent most of his time with the troops in the field rather than shuffle papers at headquarters. Both fierce and absolutely fearless in combat, he held to an easily understood credo. Now look, he once told a well-meaning officer who suggested that perhaps he shouldn't take so many risks. I was a poor country boy from the Pennsylvania Dutch country. I heard about West Point and that it was free, and I went. I made a contract with the government. If they paid for my education, I would serve them. Part of my contract was to die for my country if necessary, and I intend to stick to it. If I get killed, then so be it, but I don't expect to be. After taking over the training of the National Guardsmen who made up the 29th Infantry, Cota was just about everywhere with his walking stick, chomping on an unlit cigar. That was back on the moors of England, beginning in the summer of 1943. There, Cota had done his best to indoctrinate his men in the sights and crashing sounds of battle and the confusion. The air and naval bombardment and the artillery support are reassuring, he told his staff, but you're going to find confusion. Landing craft aren't going to go in on schedule. People are going to get landed in the wrong place. Some won't get landed at all. The enemy will try, and he'll have some success in preventing our gaining a lodgment, but we've got to improvise. We've got to carry on, not lose our heads. And we must not add to the confusion. His prophetic words describe exactly the situation on Omaha Beach moments after the first wave of American troops, the 29th Infantry included, stepped ashore on continental Europe. Omaha Beach was a nightmare. Noise, confusion, whole units landed at the wrong places, others still far from shore, and just about everybody pinned down by murderous crossfire and bodies, bodies everywhere, in the water, on the beach itself, draped over the beach obstacles, and all of them American. In the area assigned to the 29th, those GIs still living and able to move had scrambled and crawled to the base of a low seawall, 150 yards beyond the water's edge, and there the invasion stopped. No one dared to move. A carpet of men hugged the sand face down. General Cota came in with the staff of the 29th's 116th Regiment, dropping into the waist-deep water from their landing barge, 50 yards from shore, and wading in from there. Right next to Cota, Major John Sowers was hit by machine gun fire and killed on the spot. Looking at the masses of men jumbled up, unmoving behind that seawall, The German fire only increasing with each passing moment, Cota realized the paralyzed 29ers had to be galvanized into action. Now, accounts vary on what happened next, but Norm Cota was nonetheless the catalyst. According to Cornelius Ryan, in his famous book, The Longest Day, and Max Hastings, British author of Overlord, D-Day and the Battle for Normandy, Cota scooted to a halt in the sand by the seawall next to men from the 5th U.S. Rangers who were mixed in by an erroneous landing. If you Rangers, get up and lead the way. Lead the way, Rangers. A 5th U.S. Ranger who was there has it still another way. Max Schneider got at the base, saw the general and said, keep down, general, keep down. And that was, of course, Cota and his aide. By all three accounts, the specialists, the U.S. Ranger specialists, armed with Bangalore torpedoes, were able to blow vital gaps in the thick barbed wire just beyond the seawall, and then others then began to follow in a trickle that in time would become a flood, and ultimately the German defenders in that particular area were pushed back. Here and there, a few brave men up and down the long line were edging forward. Others sometimes followed with discordant but brave sallies, and Cota cajoled a motley collection of infantrymen to get up and move. He himself crawled beyond the seawall to a protective rise about 15 yards ahead. He brought a BA Armand to his side. They provided a fierce covering fire, and then another 29er blew the wire just ahead of them with another Bangalore torpedo. But then disaster. The first man running through the fresh gap was cut down by German machine gun fire. He cried, like so many young men do, for his mama, and with that piteous cry, Cota knew the men behind would be frozen into place. He had to show them what had to be done, and so he leaped up, dashing across the road and through the gap. He turned and shouted orders for others to follow, and a few brave souls did, and when they weren't hurt, their success convinced dozens of others to try it. Cota soon had a scraggly column advancing through a field beyond the beach bluff, the road, and the wire. They passed through minefields, losing several men on the way. They topped the high ground beyond the beaches. They encountered German resistance, and they forced it back. They reached the French village of Virville, and they took it. All the while, more and more men were streaming up from the beaches behind. One group met Cota on the town's main street, twirling a pistol on his index finger like an old West gunfighter. He looked at the newcomers. Where the hell you been, boys? Not through with his beach heroics yet, Cota then returned to the landing area to speed the flow of men and vehicular equipment like tanks up into the Verville draw. And this was a natural depression leading from the beach, and it was still in German hands. Cota and six men took it from the rear. Back on the beach, he set about bringing a further order to a still chaotic and dangerous scene. He reported that the draw was now clear for troop and supply movement, and he cajoled a group of GIs until one finally agreed to drive forward with a bulldozer loaded with needed TNT. On June 7th, the day after, Cota was a one-man army again. Prodding and pushing the troops now forward to the village of St. Laurent, he found an infantry captain and some men stymied outside a house occupied by Germans. When he asked why the troops weren't trying to eliminate the enemy and take the house, the inexperienced captain said, well, the Germans are in there shooting at us. Well, I'll tell you what, Cota told the young captain. You and your men start shooting at them. I'll take a squad of men, and you and your men watch carefully. I'll show you how to take a house with Germans in. The general had been unbuckling two grenades as he spoke. Now he led his men to a hedge, and they dashed toward the house, screaming like wild men, and they threw their grenades through the windows. Coda and another man kicked in the front door, tossed a few more grenades inside, waited for the explosion, and then disappeared inside the house. The Germans, surviving the assault, ran out the back doors and windows, and soon General Coda was able to report back to the stunned captain. Does the captain now know how to take a house? Yes, sir. Well, good, because I'm going to be around to do it for you again. I can't do it for everybody. The end of the month found Coda in a proud new role, commander of his own infantry division, the 28th. And on August 29th, there was Coda at the head of the 28th, marching down the Champs-Élysées of Paris, taking the salutes of Charles de Gaulle, Dwight Eisenhower, and Omar Bradley. A long way from that bloody pinned down stretch of beach called Omaha. Well, we got about 6 minutes left, and I can't really think of anything else to say. We've heard some tremendous stories from some really tremendously ordinary fellas who were called upon to do extraordinary things at an extraordinary time. War is an awful thing. I mean, we all know that, and it goes without saying. And the devastation and the loss of life, you know, that accompanies all this is absolutely nightmarish. But at the same time, I don't know that there's anything quite like war to bring out those qualities that are greatest and best in men. Sacrifice, devotion to duty. Being scared half to death and doing it anyway. We can't let these memories be sullied or tarnished. We can't let these fellows be compared to Antifa. Oh, yeah. I can't even remember the idiot's name. Doesn't matter. A stupid guy on TV who other stupid people think is considerably less stupid than they are, but they're wrong because they're stupid people. He's a really stupid guy. Equated modern-day Antifa with the fellas that hit Normandy. And that's shameful. That's absolutely shameful. ACP is heard here. Well, we haven't been lately, and we may not for a while, but we were tonight. Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We also have a recorded version of the program that rolls out Sunday afternoons, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you're not listening, you should be. The very best in conservative and libertarian talk radio out there, mojo50.com. That's all the time we've got this evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you've enjoyed our retrospective. I hope it brought to light memories of these fellas and what they did. And I hope that that light lingers a little bit and shines on these fellas a little bit longer, as it should. We'll be back next Tuesday, theoretically. At least that's what I say at the end of Thursday's show. Taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. We'll see you then.